What are your hobbies? What do you do to relax? What do you do to unwind?
After work, my favorite things are to watch like my favorite reality TV. Recently been really into Below Deck. I love to cook, actually. I'm not a great baker, but I find cooking to be creative in a way that's a little more, you have a little more freedom, I think, when you cook, you know?
A little more avant-garde.
Mm-hmm. And I like to read, although I've been in a slump, as you know. And yes. What else? I just kind of like to lay and lounge and hang out. What about you?
I have a lot of hobbies, and I cycle through them on, like, a monthly basis.
Mm-hmm.
Crochet. Was big yeah. into crocheting for a long time.
I haven't seen you with a needle, with a crochet needle lately.
I know. I've in a slump.
Well, no, you've not been in a slump. You've just been reading.
I have.
Which is your new hobby.
That is the new hobby, is audiobooks. You have gotten me into audiobooks. And that has been a journey, getting back into reading.
Yeah.
Singing. Love singing mm-hmm. for the longest time. I mean, I've up until adulthood, I was always in some form of choir. Like, that is just, like, what I did. Comics, which I guess is a form of reading.
Yeah.
I'll go through, like, comics kicks, where it's, like, that is the only thing I will read for, like, months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Pickleball for a while there.
Really?
Just like everyone else. Yeah. I think I'm always searching for the next hobby.
I feel like that sometimes too.
Adult life, man. It's wild.
Casey, I'm so happy to be back recording with you on season 2.
Oh my gosh, so am I.
It feels like a millennia since I've sat in this recording studio with you, honestly.
It has been a long, long time. And since then, all 8 episodes of season 1 are out now. That's crazy.
We have a
full season behind us. We have a full season ahead of us now.
And it feels good. I feel like we learned so much the first season. I mean, I've consumed podcasts. I've been a fan of podcasts for a long time. And I thought to myself, yeah, podcasting, you just talk into a microphone and there you have it. But it is really much more nuanced than that. And I think we're learning that and finding our footing and becoming a little more confident, and it's exciting.
And this upcoming one, I am excited about the new topics.
Yes.
The new sources.
Yes.
We're expanding more this season with where we're looking for things. So mm-hmm. trying to make things more accessible for you guys, the audience, yes. so you can read yourself. We hope you've been enjoying that.
Exciting.
Exciting stuff.
Okay, well, I guess without further ado, this episode, we are discussing recreation.
If that wasn't obvious from...
Yeah. From
our
chitter chatter. So do you want to take us
sure off? Yeah, I can start off. My article is from Traces of Indiana and Midwestern History, Fall 1998, Volume 10, Number 4. It is called Casino Gambling in the Springs Valley and the State of Indiana: Twist the Tiger's Tail mm-hmm. by Douglas Wissing.
Douglas Wissing wrote an article, one of the articles that I've been researching for this season too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I forget which one, but we will see.
See where he comes up
him again. Yes.
Doug, can I call you Doug?
Thanks, Doug. We're informal around here.
Yeah. Douglas. Mr. Wissing.
Sir Douglas Wissing.
Sir Douglas Wissing. Anyway, Wissing starts off the article by telling us about a Indianapolis Star front page headline that read, "Lid put on the French lick." And this comes in the wake of a government shutdown of gambling in the Springs Valley region.
Wow.
And it comes on the eve of the Kentucky Derby on May 7th, 1949. So Governor Henry Stricker is like, we're going to do a clean government. We are going to not be doing gambling because it is illegal in the state of Indiana. We're not going to do this.
So did he make it illegal in that moment, or was he just like being more aggressive with the policing of gambling?
He was aggressive in the policing of gambling. It had been illegal basically since our state's founding.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he goes into the history of gambling in Indiana, and it's fascinating.
Wow.
On Derby Day, 1949, the French Lick Springs Hotel was filled to capacity. It had these big-name guests like the governor of Illinois, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker of Eastern Airlines. So, like, no one.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent down the state police in conjunction with the Orange County police, and they shut it down. They're like, we're not doing this. Gambling, not on my watch. that brings to an end an era of gambling that was there for more than half a century.
So I assume you'll get into this in this article, but this gambling was happening covertly?
Not even.
So they knew whoever the, you know, they of the casinos knew it was illegal.
Oh yeah, they were fully aware that it was illegal and they just didn't care. And like how it came to be is very interesting. The French Lick Springs Hotel and the West Baden Springs Hotel were originally spa resorts. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, more spas in California and Florida, so coastal spas became popular, they were starting to lose out on their guests. So they were like, how do we shift to bring more people here? And the answer was gambling. Gambling has always been a part of our state's history, mostly in trying to suppress gambling. Mm. On July 16th, 1795, the Northwest Territory governor, Arthur St. Clair, published a law to suppress gaming, which distinguished lotteries from gaming and betting on horse races.
Hmm.
In 1810, the Indiana Territory legislated an act for the lottery to benefit the state and tried to raise $1,000 in order to benefit a library. It didn't work.
So, okay. In the 1700s, the Northwest Territory governor said no gambling.
Minus lotteries. Lotteries are cool.
So like the Hoosier Lotto would be considered. Okay.
That would be fine.
But then in 1810...
they try to use it. They're like, we're going to try to use this as a fundraiser.
Gambling or the lottery?
The lottery.
I see. Okay.
Which is technically gambling.
Yeah. It's confusing how it's like this gambling bad, this gambling.
Okay. Yeah. It's fine.
Can I ask another question? Sorry. Yeah. Maybe you'll get into this, but if you don't, I'm under the assumption that gambling was seen as sort of a non-Christian way of acting. Is that what was the motivation for making it illegal, or was there something else?
A little bit of that. It was mostly seen as something that like immoral people do. It brings a certain type of person around and crime and this and that. And so you don't want it around you.
So some of the same arguments we hear today from some places.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
I'm on board. Thank you.
In 1818, they tried to finance a canal via a lottery. It also fails.
Oh, no.
So there's a history of attempting to use gambling to raise money, and then it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1851, when the state constitution was passed, this was after all those failures and mm-hmm. then the bankruptcy of the state.
So there's lots of bad feeling about lotteries and gambling.
Bad blood with the lottery. In Article 15, Section 8, it reads, no lottery shall be authorized, nor the sale of lottery tickets be allowed. And that language remained there until 1989.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Yes, that is wild.
Because now the Hoosier Lottery is like everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that wild? This didn't stop gambling in the state because, you know, Springs Valley is one. It was established by that time. It was very popular. It's in a remote place. So like it was kind of able to be out and about, but not cause a lot of issues. And large scale gambling operations existed in a lot of the major metropolitan areas like Indianapolis, Terre Haute, Muncie, and Evansville. So it existed throughout the state. And then in 1901, the most highly touted casino opened in Long Beach, Indiana, which is up north.
Okay. I'm like, where in the world is
Northwest.
Long Beach? Got it.
It was called the Monte Carlo. They were advertising this to Chicago sporting clubs. And they were saying, you're invited to the finest equipped and only Monte Carlo in America. Delightfully situated in Lake County, Indiana, near the Standard Oil Works in Whiting, with no interference from county or state officials.
That is a bold claim to make. You're definitely operating in illegal gambling.
Don't worry.
Function.
And it was picturesque. You have like Michigan up there.
Mm-hmm.
There were accommodations for 5,000 people.
When I was growing up, I would hear adults in my life talk about the casino boat, or the river boat is what they called it. The river boat.
Up in Northwest Indiana?
In Southern Indiana.
Oh,
I think there's multiple.
Because I think there was a workaround rule.
That the water is not...
It couldn't be on the land in Indiana, but it could be on the water. So there
And I used to ask... I recently actually asked my father about it, and he said that you get on the boat and then they like will come off the shore for 5 minutes and come back. There's some technicality where if you're on water and moving, you're not considered, right? And so there's some technicality and loophole.
Something about it where, you can be on a boat and be gambling.
Yes.
Because they called it the boats up in Northwest Indiana.
Interesting.
So you have this giant, like, building, essentially. So mm-hmm. this wasn't the boats yet in okay. Northwest Indiana. This was, like, an actual casino. Physical casino in Whiting, Indiana. It was just out there being like, don't worry. No officials are going to come here. They wouldn't dare.
So bold. I guess it is fitting, though, that a casino is gambling by saying that.
Oh, my gosh.
I tried, and I succeeded. That was perfect.
I don't know how to come back from that. Besides in Northwest Indiana, we're going back down to Springs Valley. Mm-hmm. There are some who say that the West Baden Springs Hotel and the French Lick Springs Hotel were uh-huh. two of the most lavish in the world. And they were only rivaled by the Monte Carlo Casino in Monaco for opulence.
Oh, wow.
The West Baden Springs Hotel Casino was built in 1895 prior to the construction of its, like, famous domed structure.
Yeah.
And the French Lick Springs Hotel had its casino by 1901.
Are West Baden and French Lick close to each other?
I believe so. A lot of times I think they're, like, used interchangeably, but they're not the same thing.
I was going to say I've heard of them used interchangeably.
They are not the same thing.
At least not in this context yet.
No.
Do they become the same thing, maybe?
I don't think so, because I think one is still in operation.
French Lake is.
Yeah, I don't think West Bay.
They're separate.
These two casinos were so popular because they were on the trail of going to, like, Florida winter homes and coming back from Florida winter homes. So people would stop there before heading back up to wherever they were going.
Okay. They were a stop. There was a stop you made in between the two.
To have a little fun. In terms of the grandeur, people would be bejeweled, and the lower floor of the clubhouse was devoted to slot machines of all kinds and descriptions, and you would step into the colonnade into a sumptuously furnished reception room. Costly rugs covered the floors, velvet-covered chairs, and divans abounded.
Sumptuous. I love that word.
I know. It makes me want to go there.
I've been to French Lick. I went when I was a kid, and they were renovating it. And as a kid, I thought, that's a lot of gold on a ceiling.
Because how often do you see gold on ceilings?
As an 8-year-old, never.
Yeah. Then in the 1920s, you have two new owners of the bigger hotels in the area. Ed Ballard ran the West Baden Springs Hotel as part of a vast casino, real estate, and circus empire.
Mm.
Which does make me want to know more about Ed Ballard.
Yeah, I'm going to note that for later to Google. Yeah.
And then the owner of the French Lick Springs Hotel was Tom Taggart, who was a Democratic politico and businessman.
And I think IHS has published a book about Taggart.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, there is a book about Taggart. Yep. We did a book talk about the specific book a couple months
Interesting.
Ago.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. And he tried to distance himself from the gaming house, even though the casino and the hotel shared the same heating system. So there was not much
distance. A lot of separation.
Yeah, tons of separation.
He says facetiously.
Yes. And it had some famous guests. Like both of these hotels. Al Capone, he was a regular there. Cole Porter.
Wow.
John Dillinger. Diamond Jim Brady. The Marx Brothers. Hopalong Cassidy.
You did lose me later in the list, but the beginning was impressive.
The beginning was great. So those were like the high-end casino hotels, but not everyone can afford to be at sumptuous velvet-covered casinos. So there were clubs like the Club Chateau, Oxford Hotel, Ritter House, the Kentucky Club, the Indiana Club, Green Acres, the Clapboard Round Top Inn, the Homestead, the Babylon Club.
So these were all smaller, like, hotels that if you still wanted to gamble, you had to go to, like, French Lick, West Baden?
Yep. So that's kind of how that worked.
Okay.
So the Hoosier Club, formerly known as the Colonial, boomed on. Something that caught my attention in this article was apparently the top roulette operators in the country were from French Lick.
Really?
Yeah. And they migrated seasonally from Cuba and Florida to Springs Valley to Mackinac Island.
Wow.
And there were as many as 40 dealers at a time that worked the tables in the casino.
Quite. It just baffles me that this was such a large operation, that there was such this routine of, like, going seasonally and moving, and yet it was all illegal.
Yeah, no, it is completely illegal. That is something very important to keep in mind. Like, this was a booming industry in Indiana.
Established, even.
And it was completely illegal. And there was.
Yeah.
But also, I didn't realize roulette could have a top crew. Like, could have, like, the top roulette operator. Is it not just spinning a wheel?
It is. I'm sure there's more finesse to it. Everybody's got to be good at something.
And they were good at spinning a wheel. many people said that gambling and the hotels were the lifeblood of the valley, which, I mean, that seems true because tourism and that good stuff. Mm-hmm. That was coming from a attorney and Democratic gubernatorial advisor. So people were aware. The town marshals were hired at the behest of casino operators. Because you might be wondering, what is the local law enforcement doing?
Yeah.
Well, they were hired by the hotels. Prior to the establishment of the Indiana Police in 1933, enforcement of state law fell to the local sheriffs, who were subject to the community standards of the ballot box in a county with hundreds of casino workers, as well as the lure of the casino owners.
And there you have it, community interest.
They said, state rights? No. Community rights.
And I get it. I mean, you know, it was illegal and whatever, but I do understand that you have this community who is surviving off of this. They work there. They live...
That's where their money is coming from. That's their livelihoods. Yeah. But like, it is wild to think that your sheriff is the one who is supposed to be enforcing these laws. But if he did, he would be out of a job very quickly.
Interesting. Yep. I was wondering how this was
happening.
Thriving.
Yeah. Well, the other part of this that is very interesting is there was a lot of political protection from the two main owners, Ed Ballard and Taggart. Ballard was a Republican and Taggart was a Democrat. So both sides of the political aisle were covered. Mm-hmm. Taggart was well connected as he was the Democratic National Committee chairman and the leader of the state party.
How?
Yes. So they were both pretty connected.
And insulated.
And insulated, yeah. Apparently the governor's office too was in on the take for decades.
Until it wasn't.
Audie Shipman, who worked for Thomas Taggart, would drive his son's car with a star number 7 license plate to Indianapolis monthly with money from both Ed Ballard and Thomas Taggart. His destination was the governor's office.
Just bags of money to pay him off?
Yeah.
Wow.
Shipman reported that one guy couldn't believe the governor would take the money, and he said, "Mister, when the governor grabbed it, if you didn't let go of that envelope, he'd take your arm off."
I don't even know what to say to that.
I love it.
I think that is crazy. Where's the movie? That would be a fabulous movie.
I think so.
I think it's so easy to think of our ancestors as these righteous, uptight people because they wear these fancy clothes and they speak in this weird way. But we're all the same. We're all humans. And there's corruption
everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. Like you were saying, though, you were surprised that this hadn't been attempted to get shut down before.
Mm-hmm.
It had. Mm-hmm. In 1906, William Randolph Hearst tried to attack Taggart's opposition to his presidency by writing an expose about the widespread gambling
in
the valley.
He's a snitch.
To be fair, Taggart was like, William Randolph Hearst should not be the president. So this was just like...
I was going to say, why is that name familiar?
Yeah, he ran for president.
Yeah.
Hearst, in 1906, hires a mudraker, Evelyn Campbell, to write an expose of the valley, showing that Taggart has no legs to stand on when it comes to, you know, moral high ground and this and that and whatever. Ultimately, this kind of just is there and then it passes. In 1905, Governor Frank Hanley, who was a strict moralist and later the Prohibition Party's candidate for president, halted gambling in connection with horse racing at the state fair, and he was spurred by Hearst to send the state militia in assistance with the Orange County Sheriff to raid the Spring Valley clubs.
I think the militia's a bit much, personally.
I mean, by that time, there was no state police force, so.
Oh, that's right. So it was militia or it was nothing.
It was nothing, yeah.
Dang.
Or saying, pretty please, Orange County.
Please, stop what you're doing.
Go against.
Out of the kindness of your heart.
Lose your job. The state sued for receivership and the revocation of the hotel charters. They were like, we're shutting this down.
Yeah, for real.
We're done. That didn't work out.
You don't say.
So the state case was assigned to Orange County Judge.
Shut up.
Thomas B. Buskirk.
Orange County Judge? You're kidding me.
So an Orange County judge who allegedly enjoyed the gaming tables himself.
Wait. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm shocked that it was an Orange County judge, but should I not be? Like, I mean, I'm assuming this state, is a federal judge.
It's a state level judge.
A state level judge,
yeah,
yes.
Because it's a state
case.
Okay,
so I just didn't know if this was happening in the Orange County courts and that my surprise was unfounded or if I was accurate in the irony.
I guess it makes sense for it to be an Orange County court judge because, like, if something happened in Marion County, you'd on a state level, it'd be the state level Marion court appellate.
I always thought state government, the way that the state judges were, they were from all over and then it was random. So maybe my surprise is unfounded. I don't know.
But maybe it is founded.
It seems ironic, but maybe it's not.
It seems sketchy.
Seems interesting, for sure.
Yeah. But Thomas B. Buskirk, who was an associate of Thomas Taggart, got the case, and he rules in favor of the defense. This gets drifted through the fogs of political convenience, and after a shift in governorships,
just goes away.
Gone. Poof. In 1933, Governor Paul McNutt, who was no stranger to French Lick, recommended to the legislation that the Indiana State Police should be formed.
Okay.
And Al Feeney, who used to be a captain of the Notre Dame football team, becomes the first head of the state police. And one of his first acts was to attempt to close down gambling in French Lick and West Baden Springs. He is successful for a little bit.
I have a question. Sorry.
Yeah.
Is it a correct assumption or safe to say that the state police were founded because of gambling? Or, I mean, obviously the need for a state police existed before, but it seemed like gambling and the state police, did they fuel each other?
I don't think so, because the governor himself had enjoyed gambling at French
Lick. That's an excellent point. So he wasn't creating it to get rid of gambling.
And after this shutdown, air quotes, shutdown.
But wait, so he hires the police. Uh-huh. He makes a state police. He hires this gentleman. And the first thing this gentleman does is go after gambling, even though the governor's a huge gambler.
I don't know if I would say the governor is a huge gambler.
Okay, but even though the governor enjoys a touch of gambling?
Yes, that's exactly.
That's so funny.
Governor McNutt, though opposed, air quotes, opposed to gambling, responded by sacking Feeney.
Shut up.
He goes,
you're done.
You're done.
See ya.
That was a step too far, sir.
What, we didn't ask you to do that.
We didn't. No, we asked.
Cool your jets, buddy.
Enforce the laws, but not that law.
Wow.
State authorities tolerated the Springs Valley because, again, it was in a remote location and it generally patronized classes that had disposable income to lose.
Sure.
And now you think everyone's here for the gambling. They want the gambling. In 1934, a flyer from the Citizens Committee said that gamblers came to the valley like lecherous parasites to prey on the people. It went on to say that when gambling is allowed unfettered, as it always has been in West Baden and French Lick, the right to exist cannot be denied to all other forms of evil and debauchery. The example is paved to admittance for the underworld's licentiousness in all its sordid ramifications. Numerous times, the decent citizens of both towns, who after all in the great majority, having endeavored to stamp out the activities of the unwholesome element, have met with defiance and rebuff of this element, and efforts to do away with it have been hopelessly futile.
That is a lot.
They weren't thrilled, some of them. But, you know, I guess the silent majority maybe, but also money talks, you know, all those different types of
motivations, yeah.
Now, in 1946, Thomas D. Taggart, the son of Thomas Taggart, sells the hotel to John Cabot. While there were slot machines in the French Lick Hotel during Taggart's ownership, gambling became increasingly flagrant under Cabot's ownership.
So it went from a mild sort of tamed gambling to this, I don't know
well,
what you call
I mean,
it.
I thought it was pretty flagrant before.
Yeah, but
apparently John Cabot said, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah, literally.
So he installed slot machines into the upstairs hotel corridors.
In the hallways?
Yeah, just in case.
In case.
Just in case you wanted to gamble one more time before leaving. And then in 1949, Thomas D. Taggart died. And after that, the political protection
died with him.
Died with him. And that's when the raids closed down the Springs.
That gets us to the beginning, top of the article.
Yep. Over the next couple decades, they closed down. Before that, the West Baden Springs Hotel had already closed in 1929. The Jesuits took over that property in 1934 and attempted to restore it. And then in 1983, the college that had bought it was gone.
Did you say college?
Yeah. There was a private college, the Norwood Institute, that had bought it in 1934 that had closed by 1983. And it had stood empty for the first time since its opening in 1903.
And this is French Lick?
That is
West Baden.
In January 1991, 6 floors at the back of the hotel crashed to the ground.
Oh my.
But it saw new hope in 1996 when the Historic Landmarks Foundation and the Cook Group combined their efforts to restore the structure. Now, that was in 1997. This article is written in 1998. I believe it's been restored.
I have no idea.
We should find that out.
Google it. Oh, where's your phone? Or just Google Power of the internet, baby.
List. It's a national historic landmark.
Is it a hotel or just some place you visit?
It says it's open. 2:34 a night. Road trip?
I was going to say, we take a trip.
Road trip?
2:34, baby.
Well, its website is part of the French Lick Resort website.
So they are joined together.
Well, now they are.
Yes.
And it is a fully operating hotel.
So sometime between when this article was written, probably, and present day.
I mean, that's stunning.
It's funny. I've seen that photo.
Well, that's West Baden.
I've seen that photo, and I've seen people in that space before, but I never knew what it was. That's beautiful. Yeah.
The preservation efforts started in 1997. It has since been restored and is a fully operating hotel.
Very cool. What about French Lick?
French Lick, I think, was always fine because I think it just got bought out by Cabot. Gambling went away.
Became just a hotel, probably?
Yeah, they more so focused after that on, like, conventions, golfing, things like that.
Oh, resort-type style. Resort-type
things, yes. Got it. And that's where that was. Kind of took away a large source of revenue for this area, though, because Audie Shipman, who was the young man who was driving money to the governor's office, said that he recalled a story where people drove up in a big car, yelled out to the doorman, "Is gambling back yet?" And the doorman said, "Nope." And they said, "Well, we're heading to St. Louis." And that is how Mr. Wissing ends the article.
Fascinating.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, interesting. I wonder when the law changed that said that casinos could be, exist.
Yeah, I don't know.
Just be.
Well, you know, like all other things, alcohol, tobacco, the government makes money off gambling, right? It's a source of income.
Yeah.
So somebody at some point was like, hey, you know what? Maybe we could make some dough.
Yeah, let's make some money. Let's charge.
Yeah.
Which I'm not actually sure what the taxes on gambling are.
I couldn't tell you.
No, me either.
I think if you win over a certain amount, you get charged. It's like an income, you know,
sure.
Like
sure, yeah,
you know,
because that's true of the lottery too.
I think it's over like 5,000.
Is it
5,000 or 2,000?
Gambling, a very lucrative industry for Indiana, even though it was illegal for literally decades,
literally forever.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
My article is, I think, the opposite in almost every conceivable way.
Wholesome, no police.
It's about quilting. Quilting, the quilting arts, much different than casinos. My article is called Marie Webster, Marion's Master Quilter. It was written by Rosalind Webster Perry, who happens to be the granddaughter of Marie Webster, the star of this article. This was published in Traces of Indiana and Midwestern History, Spring 1991, Volume 3, Number 2. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of this article, there are a few things I just wanted to point out. This article is written by the granddaughter of the subject, which is really cool. But in the article itself, there's a bit of like a footnote that says that this article is adapted by permission from the author's biography. So the author of this article, Rosalind Webster Perry, wrote a book about her grandmother, Marie Webster, and her quilting. And this article is sort of based on that and adapted from that. But there were some permissions required, and I just wanted to get that out there in the front. If you are intrigued at all by this article and you want to learn more about Rosalind's work, about her grandmother, she has published a book, and there is a snippet about how to acquire a copy of the book in this footnote in the Traces article that we will link in the show notes. That's the first thing. The second thing is that this article mentions frequently some exhibits and exhibitions that are going on that obviously are no longer, I mean, this was in 1991, so this is no longer happening, but I just wanted to make sure that was clear in case anybody got confused. Okay. Oh, the third thing is this article is really full of like beautiful images of quilts. And actually, I think this entire issue traces has some quilting imagery as well. So if you are a quilter and this interests you, I really recommend looking at the article because it's really pretty. Finally, the article.
Lots of housekeeping.
Lots of housekeeping, but I just thought that was all important information. So Marie Webster is the star of the show, like I said, and her granddaughter wrote this piece. And Rosalind starts this article by saying that 1991 is the year of the quilt. And I thought, oh, what? What's that?
Like the year of the dragon.
Yeah, I'm like, the year of the quilt? All right. She didn't elaborate much on what that meant, so I had to do some of my own little research. I discovered that in 1991, the governor of Indiana at the time, who was Evan Bayh, declared that 1991 was the year of the quilt. All of this information is coming from an article that was published in the March 27th, 1991 issue of the Times Post out of Pendleton, Indiana. So the Year of the Quilt was created by Governor Bai in an effort to recognize and celebrate the artistic expression created by residents of our state and ancestors. This was also happening at the end of a quilt registry project, which was known as the Indiana Quilt Registry Project. And that was a 4-year research project where volunteers would search for, document, and photograph more than 6,000 quilts around Indiana. And then some of these quilts were then used in an exhibition at Indiana State Museum. So there was this really big preserving effort around quilts. I don't know why quilts were having their moment in 1991, but they were. And good for them.
They were in.
Yes.
They were the it girl.
Rosalind also goes on to say that one of the high points of this Year of the Quilt is the fact that Indiana has an exhibit called Marie Webster Quilts, which was at the IMA. And this exhibit at the IMA, now known as Newfields, but it was the Indiana Museum of Art before it was Newfields. So if you've lived or been in Indianapolis, lived in Indianapolis for a while, the IMA is familiar to you. If you're newer, it is now called Newfield, so the art museum. The IMA had an exhibit titled Marie Webster Quilts, and it showcased information about Marie and obviously her quilting. And this exhibit also coincided with the inauguration of the museum's new textile gallery. So a lot was happening in the world of textile and quilting in this time. I obviously know what a quilt is, but I don't know a lot about quilting. Do you?
I think there's like patch sewing involved.
Yeah.
You know.
I think they're called, I don't know, we'll get into this. I think they're called applique, and maybe you can confirm that that's what you're thinking of, but.
Sure, why not?
Anyway, I wanted to provide a brief history of quilting. The author, Perry, does include all of this information in her article, but just I wanted to get this out of the way because it's kind of helpful. Quilting has been a major form of artistic expression and a social outlet for women since the 1800s. Women would trade like quilting patterns, and they would gather for these things called quilting bees, which I think were a gathering of women who were trading quilting supplies, but also I think quilting together in like a group. By the end of the 1800s, though, most women had put away their, quote, cumbersome quilting frames and transitioned to this new style of quilting called crazy quilts. Crazy quilts are these more erratic designed quilts. They have a lot more color and texture. They'll have like lace elements. They'll have like beading. It is very colorful and kind of crazy. There's different kinds of fabrics. Whoa. It is the definition of a crazy quilt. I mean, they're quite interesting looking. But of course, crazy quilts are not for everybody. The style is not for everybody. And in fact, Marie was not that big of a fan of a crazy quilt. She was more of a traditional quilter, I would say. And her rise to fame in the quilting world was really a reaction to the crazy quilts and this, or this trend. Like I said, her style was really centered on like simple but beautiful. And she used applique, which I was just talking about. And appliques are when you cut a shape. So like, let's say you're making a quilt about flowers. You would have your base fabric of quilt, right? Let's say it's like white or something. And then from a different fabric, you would cut out the shape of a flower and a stem and maybe like some leaves, right? Yeah. And then you would apply it to the top of the quilt.
Yes.
And that is the applique process, which is what I think of when I think of a quilt.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So because of this diversion from the crazy quilt trend, some components of Mary's quilting were kind of seen as like these great innovations. Like she was seen as a trendsetter of a different kind. And Marie found herself like right at the precipice of a quilt revival that was based on the growing popularity of home decor style of colonial origin. Think of like rocking chairs and like really rustic sort of looking.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, it was sort of this trend of the time to have colonial decor in your home. And what this meant for a lot of women is that they were rediscovering family heirlooms or, quote, vintage or antique looking things that were their family members from years past. And part of that was quilts. They would pull out quilts that they hadn't looked at for a while and be like, oh, that's really cute. And so there was a revival of this style of quilting. And Marie was
like the 90s right now.
Exactly. Many people were interested in this reconnection of like their past and their family history through quilts, which I think is really interesting. So who is Marie Doherty Webster? I'm really happy to tell you. Marie.
I'm so glad you asked.
I'm so glad. Marie is recognized as one of the most influential quilt designers in the 20th century. She was born on July 19th, 1859 in Wabash, Indiana. She did die in 1956, so she lived quite a full life. Yeah, but a life...
Almost 100 years.
I think it was like 96 or 7, yeah. 97. But she lived a life that spanned the Civil War, you know, the First and Second World Wars, the Great Depression. She lived through a lot.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, right? I think a lot of that kind of influenced her style to be more traditional, if you will. Like something about...
Something about yearning for a simpler time.
Or sticking to your roots, maybe. Yeah. That kind of thing.
Something familiar. Nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She was the oldest of six children, and her father's name was Josiah Scott Doherty, and he was a successful entrepreneur, bank president, and civic leader in the community. And her mother was Minerva Harriet Lumery.
What a name.
Right?
Can you say that one more time?
Minerva Harriet Lumery.
Ooh.
I know.
I love that.
Me too. The author provides some genealogical background for this family. Both of her parents were actually pioneer settlers to Indiana whose families had journeyed in covered wagons from Ohio before 1850.
I mean, 1816 was when Indiana became a state. So.
Right. But I think maybe in that area they were...
Pre-constitution.
Yeah. And maybe they were...
state constitution.
Pioneers in the area. I don't know. But that's what the author says. Marie graduated from high school in 1878 and she wanted to go to college. But her parents said, no, you are not strong enough. You're too frail to do that.
Oh my.
Yeah, I know. Which is sort of disappointing because we'll learn in this piece that Marie is so bright and talented, and I just couldn't imagine.
I wonder what she would have gone to college for.
I don't know. So her parents say, no, you're not going. So Marie's like, okay, all right. The author points out, though, in kind of like a funny little snide remark, that Marie outlived all of her siblings to 97. So her parents called her frail, but I don't know.
She was long-lasting.
Yeah, she was. Not quite that frail. Marie was described by the author as a fashionable and witty young woman who had pretty auburn hair and sparkling hazel eyes. And we have a few photos of Marie in our digital collection. They're not colorized, but she is quite a beautiful lady. And we will put those in the show notes.
Yeah.
Great to see. Marie married George Webster Jr., who was a businessman, and he was from Marion, Indiana. And they got married on Valentine's Day in 1884.
Cute.
Very romantic. They had one child whose name was Lawrence, and Lawrence and George and Marie all lived most of their lives in Marion, Indiana. Eventually, Marie ran a really successful pattern business from her home, so patterns for quilts. She did that for about 30 years. Her designs were sold to quilters around the world, and her designs were really coveted. She was also a published author, and she wrote the first book that was devoted entirely to the subject of quilting. And I'll
she
get.
She said, I don't need to go to college.
No, I'm going to just be a master quilter.
To become a master quilting
author. Yeah, businesswoman. And I'll get into a lot more of this in a minute. I'm just kind of giving you a background of Marie. The author says, quote, no one would have been more surprised than Marie to see her quilts hanging in any major art museum. So she seemed quite a humble woman, I think.
Humble lady there.
Yes. She goes on to say that Marie would have been surprised about all of this because she had no real formal training in like arts or any artistic kind of field. She was a seamstress. She did sew, like I think many women of the time, but she was 50 years old when she started quilting. So this wasn't something she'd been doing for her whole life.
No. What was she doing before that?
Being a homemaker, she loved to travel and I think spend time with her family and, you know, she sewed and things like that. I think just life. Her first quilt, so she starts quilting around 1909, to give you some context.
That is very inspiring to know that you can feel like you're not having your start, not doing what you're supposed to be doing or whatever. Yeah. And then,
or maybe that your start was thwarted.
Sure.
You didn't get the original plan, but that.
Yeah. Or your plan has changed. Like you haven't found your niche, but don't worry. 50 is around the corner.
I know.
And that can be
it is so inspiring, isn't it? I think especially for people our age who feel so much pressure to be so much so soon.
And there's a lot of quote unquote life trajectory points that I feel either get missed by a certain age that people feel like, oh, I'm behind. I don't think that's necessarily
the case. Marie is a beautiful example of that.
Example,
I love her for this. Her first quilt that she ever created was a design of her own creation, and it was an interpretation of the classic motif of the Rose of Sharon, this classic looking rose. Her friends and family were just flabbergasted because she'd never quilted before. She had just raw talent. They were like, whoa, Marie, you crushed it.
Whoa, you're actually good at this.
Whoa. I mean, how often do you try a thing and you're good at it? For me, not very frequently. For Marie...
She
just
said,
a Tuesday.
Quilting.
Her friends and family were just incredibly impressed by her craftsmanship, and so they urged her to send the quilts to the Ladies' Home Journal, which was this really big, popular magazine for women at the time. Marie, in her story, does owe a little bit of her fame to Edward Bach, who was the editor of the Ladies' Home Journal. And because he saw her talent immediately, he encouraged her to allow him to publish color prints of her quilting work. Four of her quilts appeared in the January 1911 issue of the Ladies' Home Journal. So 2 years after starting quilting, she's a published quilter. For context, this magazine reached about 2 million homes.
Oh my. Yeah. I mean, that's not nothing back then.
No. And she very quickly became the nation's first quilt celebrity. So she shoots to fame. I think this was all...
So I'm trying to think, who is another person who would be similar to Marie? Like, who's the quilting star of someone who's making something and, like, gaining notoriety?
You know, I actually follow this woman on Instagram, and she runs a small business, and she's really cool. She makes these really cool patterns, and so she's the Marie Webster to me. She's not, I don't think, as big as Marie was, but that's what first comes to mind.
For me, like, TikTok artists kind of come up first, like musicians, like, who kind of make it big from being on TikTok and their songs go viral. But, do you know who Kyle... I think her last name is Jusczyk. I'm so sorry. J-U-S-Z-C-Z-Y-K.
Kyle.
Oh, Kyle. Yeah. Kyle is the wife of a football player on the 49ers.
Oh.
And she made the jacket, the 87 jacket that Taylor Swift wore.
Oh, just in this most recent game, right? The really cool.
I think so. Yeah, the one that's like a puffer jacket that it's made out of like a jersey. She's gaining a lot of like notoriety and followers for her designs because she made those all of herself. And I think she made a vest for Simone Biles too, for her husband's jersey number.
It's really interesting you asked this question because I have been seeing more people who are taking up sewing for the first time, like our age, who are like, I want to be able to mend, I want to be able to hem or to adjust, or I want to be able to make my own thing. And I want a sewing machine now because I want to sew. It's going to be my new hobby, maybe.
There you go. Yeah. Your new hobby.
Yeah. So thank you, Marie, and thank you, people of the internet. I know how to sew, too, but I don't have a sewing machine.
My sisters have a sewing machine.
Really? My mom.
Our grandma taught us, yeah.
Too. My grandma taught me, too. My grandma was a beautiful sewer. She's made me, like, pajamas and blankets and stuff.
My grandma makes us pajamas every year for Christmas.
That's adorable. Meemaw?
Yep, Meemaw.
Yay, Meemaw. That's so cute. I want to learn to sew because I think it'd just be fun to make things. You don't have to like make incredible, crazy, like elaborate things. No, you can just make anything.
I mean, that's why I got into crochet. Less poking.
Yeah, but you can and you can make purses and tops and hats and all stuff that. Yeah, very cool. Anyway. All right. Okay. Yeah. So that was a great question, Casey. But so Marie, she shoots to quilt fame. She's the first quilt celebrity ever in this nation. And she was, I think, understandably somewhat overwhelmed by all of this fame. So she relied really heavily on her family to help her navigate life at this point. Her son, Lawrence, who was a Harvard-educated engineer, would help her by blueprinting her patterns.
She doesn't go to college, but her son becomes a Harvard-educated engineer.
Yeah, well, you want more for your kids, right? Yeah.
Well, that's just not to say that, like, you need to go to college to become successful, but could you imagine what she could have done with, like, considering
that's
her
what
child
I was thinking
went to Harvard?
At the top of the episode or my piece is that having read this, she's a brilliant person. She's smart, and to think that her family thought she was too frail.
I wonder what they meant by that.
I don't know if they meant, like, her constitution was too weak, right?
Yeah.
Or if she was actually sickly. But nowhere in this article does Perry mention any sort of like
illness
or any sort of like lifelong condition.
Well, and Perry's her granddaughter, right?
Yeah. That feels like it would have been a big part of the story, maybe like a chronic condition, because that would have been just another impressive thing that Marie would have overcome.
Anyway.
Regardless, I think she's got brains, her son's got brains, and he helped her in the quilting. Blueprint. He would use his little engineer mind and make blueprints for her quilts. Her sister, Emma, also helped, and Emma would make these full-size mock-ups of Marie's designs using tissue paper so that Marie could kind of see it grand scale.
I wonder why tissue paper. That feels like it'd be very flimsy.
I think it was...
Or maybe they would just do a square. Because I'm imagining scale, like a full...
They did a full mock-up. Oh. I think maybe what she would do is take like... the actual back of the quilt, right? The big rectangle.
Sure.
And then maybe cut out bits of tissue paper to place it and kind of see.
I could, that you know what I'm saying? Sense. Was there any pictures in the article?
No, not of the tissue paper, but of other quilts, yes.
I want to see
them. Her quilts are beautiful.
Mock-ups.
Her quilts are beautiful. So her sister helped her. Her son was helping her. And within a month of all of this happening, her quilt pattern business, which was called Marie Webster's New Patchwork Quilts, was doing really well. And they were selling patterns for about 50 cents a piece. Her quilts were on display at Marshall Fields, which is a department store in Chicago.
Yes, very
familiar. And yes, you would be. And three more color pages of her designs were printed in the Ladies' Home Journal. So she was just a superstar all of a sudden. We're talking a lot about her quilts. You may be wondering what her quilts look like. Well, they were, as this article put it, startlingly fresh. They were inspired by her watching her flower garden, admiring her flowers. And they were centered a lot in the arts and crafts movement as well. And the arts and crafts movement is this style or this idea that stressed the honesty of natural forms and of natural materials and the virtues of simple and handmade things. So kind of like making things simple and beautiful and durable, like classic. The author describes her quilts as noteworthy for their quiet beauty, their understated elegance, and their outstanding workmanship. Her style of graceful, natural forms and harmonious palette of pastel colors were soon copied by many other designers in the 20s and 30s. She was able to expertly incorporate color and shape and texture to create this beautiful piece. In true arts and crafts style, her quilts were really practical. They were intended to be used and washed and stored, and, you know, they were not just art pieces, they were practical for everyday living. Marie was able to combine the traditional quilt making of the 19th century with modern innovation in the 20th century, like new meets old. I did mention earlier on that Marie published a book. This book was published by the Doubleday, Page, and Company publishers, and they approached Marie to write a history of quilts. The goal for the book was to appeal not only to like a general audience, but also to those who were really interested in needlework and quilting, and also antique collectors. So like people who were interested in antique quilts and things like that. Her book was titled Quilts, Their Story and How to Make Them, and it was published in 1915 and had rave reviews. It provided not only a history of the origins of quilting, but it also stressed the importance of quilts in the American experience. It included chapters on technique, it had humor, pioneer folklore was included, and it also provided a list of over 400 patterns and their names.
That is a lot of patterns.
Mm-hmm. Or excuse me, just pattern names, not patterns themselves. Excuse me. Above all, Marie pleaded the case on the importance of quilting, and this article includes a little excerpt on that, and I'm going to share that with you now. The work of the old-time quilters possesses artistic merit to a very high degree. While much of it was designed strictly for utilitarian purposes, in fact, more for rugged service than display, yet the number of beautiful old quilts which these industrious ancestors have bequeathed to us is very large. Every now and then there comes to light one of these old quilts of the most exquisite loveliness, in which the needlework is almost painful in its exactness. Such treasures are worthy of study and imitation, and are deserving of careful preservation for the inspiration of future generations of quilters. And I love this little excerpt because it sort of rounds out the opening of the article when we were talking about the year of the quilt.
Yeah.
And this is why there was so much time and effort dedicated to quilting, because it is a beautiful art form and because it is a part of our history in a way that maybe we may not initially overtly think of it.
Yeah, as. No, that's true.
People all over the world were really impressed with her work, not only in her quilting style, but in her book. I mean, and we're talking people in China and Finland and India and New Zealand, just to name a few. And she was even invited to speak to groups about her book and her expertise, and she was just a quilt master. I am so impressed with Marie, honestly. I'm like her biggest fan. So in 1920, the quilting revival kind of peaked at this point, and Marie's business expanded. Her sister, and some friends started the Practical Patchwork Company, which specialized in quilting kits and finished quilts.
The kit thing
is genius, right?
It's genius. Well, it's coming back again. Mm-hmm. Like, not specifically with quilting, but like,
I'm thinking of like those crochet kits where you can make that look. Yes, yes, that. They're all over my Instagram.
Always. Yeah. No, that whole kind of idea, though, is coming back. Like, I feel like needlepoint kits are becoming a big thing again.
I'm telling you, needlework in all forms is coming back.
Yeah, a lot of it is just like, it's there now, and maybe it's because people are like, we need a hobby that we can stay home, do, and not spend money.
Save money, make something that fits us, that feels good. And I think there's this sort of distancing from fast fashion that's really big right now, is trying to find things that aren't exploitative, that are not
Or like wasteful. Going to like a Goodwill or some type of thrifting and creating something new out of something old.
Giving something new life. Yeah, absolutely. The motto of her company was "A thing of beauty is a joy forever," which is really cute. That should be on a little pillow.
That should be needlepointed on.
Somebody needlepoint that, please. Okay, so in the 1930s, Marie had over 20 of her like signature developed designs in her line. This line was the kits and the finished quilts. And prices ranged from about $100 for her most expensive finished quilt to about $5 for a modest baby quilt kit. Suppliers would use her designs, steal her designs, basically, change the name and never give her credit, and then market it as their own. And these patterns are kind of popular today still, ones that have origins in Marie's work but aren't given Marie credit. So really the impact of her quilting is really far reaching. And Marie was this, I think we've touched on this a lot, but the fact that Marie was without any formal training, but she was endowed, the author puts it, with an undeniable talent and support and just smarts and all the things to make her hobby successful. So that's Marie.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have not thought about quilting that much.
No, but I agree. And this really changed my mind and sort of opened my eyes to quilting is sort of this marker of historic happening. Like it's sort of this
I love
artifact.
Quilt, though, I will say.
No one in my family are quilters.
No one's
really.
A quilter, but like.
I think maybe a great grandma of mine was a quilter, but I don't have any of her quilts. As we're talking about trying new things and whatever and being good at things, I think it's worth noting that you don't have to be good at everything you do. I can paint watercolor and it may not be beautiful, but it was fun or it was creative or I had an outlet. You don't have to be Marie level good.
That's true. Also, on a completely unrelated note, she was essentially alive for the entire run of gambling.
She was. Yeah, it is fascinating that she was alive for all of that.
Listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. We are so happy to have you, and we're so happy to be back and kicking off this second season with you. We have so many more incredible stories to tell, and we hope you join us for each and every episode.